Leonard Zabik lived in Somerville, New Jersey, in his parents' three-bedroom ranch house. His was the first name on Dr. Eric von Breslau's list. There was an ambulance parked out front when Remo and Chun arrived. Its lights were off, its sirens quiet. Remo left his rented car across the street and strolled over to the Zabik home. Two slow-moving attendants were bringing out a sheet-draped stretcher when Remo and Chun walked up. The men continued working, used to morbid curiosity seekers.
Hey!
Without warning, Chun pulled the sheet away as the men were lifting the body into the back of the ambulance.
This is the one we seek.
Is this man Leonard Zabik?
Yeah? What business is it of yours?
What happened?
Well, we're not sure. He was dead before we got here. Hey, if you want my guess, though, I'd say an overdose.
The man pulled the sheet back over Leonard Zabik's face, and they proceeded to load the body onto the back of the ambulance.
What do you make of that?
His body rejected that which it had not earned.
I'd better go see what happened.
He started up the driveway. He was stopped before he had even gotten halfway.
Yoo-hoo!
The voice came from next door. A frumpy woman in her early 70s was waving from the front lawn of the house next door. Remo crossed the driveway to a small picket fence, Chun on his heels.
Are you with the police or something?
Something.
I am. He's not.
Well, either way. I'm Gladys Finkel. I live next door. I saw the whole thing, officer. That boy went nuts. Absolutely stark raving nuts.
What do you mean?
I go over there some mornings to have coffee with Edna, Leonard's mother. Lovely woman. Anyway, I was there this morning, and she goes in to wake him because he's going to be late for work. He's in the business side of some computer place in Edison. Well, he comes ripping out of that room like the house is on fire. I never saw anything like it in my whole life. He's breaking cupboards with his bare hands and chipping Edna's beautiful Formica countertop. I swear he crushed the front of the fridge, bent the door right in half. He had a wild look in his eye, almost like he couldn't stop himself. Finally, he just collapsed right there on the kitchen floor.
He died just like that?
His legs kicked out for a while, and his arms, like he was doing some kind of judo or something. He was gone before the ambulance drivers got here.
Remo nodded. The poor guy had been a victim of his body's inability to adapt to the Shinanju information. He probably didn't even know what had happened to him. They had literally reached a dead end. And if Zabik was dead, the other poor guinea pigs would be soon to follow.
Well, Mrs. Finkel, thank you for your time.
Oh, and, you know, the funny thing is, I went over this morning to see if everything was okay. I thought I saw an ambulance here in the wee hours.
Really?
Yeah. There was a big white truck parked in the driveway. My eyes aren't too good anymore. That's why I went to see Edna. I thought something might be wrong.
Did she say whose truck it was?
It was Leonard's boss or something. He took Leonard into the truck for a while and then let him go. Hey, do you think that had something to do with Leonard dying?
Aaron's salon didn't feel very well when he awoke that morning.
Hello?
Hi, boss. It's Aaron's salon. I'm afraid I can't come in today.
Oh, that's too bad. A lot of stuff is going on over here at Platt Deutsche. I could have used you today.
Oh, I'll see if I can find some aspirin and try
it. Oh, no worries. We just have an internal matter that could use our expertise. Most of the R&D department has just vanished. Dr. Newton was found in a fourth floor maintenance closet dead of a gunshot wound.
Really? Oh, wow. I just worked with him a few days ago.
Yeah, I remember you volunteering for his special assignment. Hope you're not feeling bad from that. Well, just take it easy for a few days. The company will still be here when you get back.
Thanks, boss. Bye.
20 minutes later, Aaron was lying on the living room sofa. He had just sat down for some morning cereal when the palpitations began. He could feel his heart begin to beat irregularly, almost as if the organ were inflating like an overfull water balloon inside his chest. It felt like it would burst. His breathing was still good, centered. It had been that way since he had agreed to undergo the strange test for Platt Deutsche Vice President Lothar Holtz. He didn't know how he knew the breathing to be right. He only knew it was. And that for the past 37 years, he had been breathing completely wrong. Now, though, it was as if every perfect breath his lungs pulled in was causing his heart muscle to expand and contract wildly.
I'm having a heart attack. Oh.
He grabbed for the phone. It tumbled off the table near the couch. He clawed for it on the rug. The blood pounding from his chest cavity was ringing hollowly inside his ears. His hand found the phone. He tried to pull it toward him. It wouldn't budge. Only then did he notice that someone was standing on the cord. He recognized the man. Young, long blonde hair. He had seen him around the office. Behind him was another man. Salon knew him as well. Lothar Holtz. The two men picked Aaron Salon off the couch and carried him out the kitchen door.
You'd taken me to a hospital, right? You know something went wrong in your tests. You're taking me for help.
That's right. We're taking you for help. Can you open the door? Thank you. Now, don't move.
The van didn't move for 5 minutes. Then, two figures got out, carrying a large, awkward bundle. The same figures returned a moment later, alone.
This one's gone too.
Aaron Salon lay at the far end of his driveway behind a pair of trash barrels.
It was the interface.
Are you sure?
Note the circular marks on his forehead.
Remo squinted. Two round impressions were faintly visible in the flesh at Aaron Salon's temples. They were consistent with the marks made by the rubber suction cups on Holtz's temple electrodes.
We'd better get to the next one on the list. What is Holtz doing?
Simon Waxman's wife was leaving her apartment when Remo arrived. She was accompanied by her mother-in-law. Simon's father was off handling the funeral arrangements. Holtz had already been there. The young woman was so distraught, Remo didn't detain her. The same was true for the next four names on the list. All had met with Lothar Holtz earlier in the morning. All were dead. It was afternoon before they reached the final name on the list. The apartment complex where David Lieb lived was near Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Remo left his car in a guest spot in the small parking area, and he and Chun made their way to the string of two-story buildings.
They have been here already.
No use pretending, then. After you, little father.
Subtlety is an art I fear you may never learn.
They found David Lieb on the floor of his bedroom. All around the room was in disarray. The walls were broken. The bed collapsed. A bureau had been split into two neat halves. Chun crouched down near the body.
This one still lives.
Remo stooped down beside the master of Shenanju. The pupils of the young man on the floor were pinpricks. His eyes roamed their sockets sightlessly.
How long ago was Holtz here?
Hours. Hours.
What did he want?
He wanted my head.
The interface system.
Yes. He steals back that which was not his to give. He is going into...
The breathing. It felt so... so right.
Shun nodded his understanding. Lieb smiled. Remo noted that in death, Lieb had centered himself. His arms and legs were in perfect harmony with the forces of the universe. Chun gently closed the young man's eyelids.
I better call Smith.
Remo, where have you been?
Chun found a list in Newton's lab. We've been visiting the homes of the people on the list. They're all the people Holtz experimented on. And every one of them have turned up dead, but not before Holtz paid him a visit. I think he's retrieving the Shinanju data from their minds before they die.
A list? Why did Chun not show the list to me?
I guess he thought it was family business.
It was.
I see. Please return to Folcroft immediately.
Why? Is something up?
They have found one of the missing ambassadors.
Wearing grim expressions, the network anchors broke into the afternoon soap operas, each telling the same story. Arkadya Rokossovsky, Russian ambassador to the United Nations, had entered the offices of Schuler Designs on the 57th floor of the Empire State Building at approximately 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. He was questioned by the firm's receptionist, but Rokossovsky had ignored her. Rokossovsky had wandered beyond the woman's desk and into the office. Several people asked what he was doing, but he trudged resolutely past them. It was only when he got to the window that someone thought to call security, but by then it was too late. The window panes had been specially devised for high buildings. They were triple-enforced plates of high-density polymer. Invisible steel strands crisscrossed the pane. Each window was guaranteed by the manufacturer to withstand 1,000 pounds per square inch of pressure. A marketing embellishment, as most people had imagined, but it was understood that the panes could not be shattered by conventional means. It was agreed by all that Arkadya Rokossovsky should never have been able to break one. In a crowded conference room, Rokossovsky kicked out with the heel of his foot. It impacted with the center of a high window pane. Against all design specifications, the heavy plastic rattled on its frame, a long spidery fracture spreading up its middle. Finally, the pane cracked apart in a half dozen huge sections. Broken sheets of simulated glass exploded out onto Fifth Avenue. Rokossovsky followed them. Those who witnessed the obvious suicide found it troublesome for more than just the apparent reasons. To a man, they all said the same thing. Arkadya Rokossovsky didn't look or sound like someone who wanted to die. His actions were incongruous with his words, or at least to his tone. From the moment he stepped through the office door to the instant he impacted with the sidewalk far below, Rokossovsky could be heard screaming in Russian. An immigrant who was standing nearby when Rokossovsky hit the ground translated his final words for the networks. Psychologically, it all seemed to fit. Loosely interpreted, Arkadya Rokossovsky had been pleading for someone to stop the voices inside his head. Holtz had wanted Rokossovsky to do a swan dive off of the observation platform at the top of the Empire State Building, but was disappointed to find that the powerful antenna high atop the structure would have interfered with the signal. Reluctantly, he had opted for the 57th floor. The Dynamic Interface System van had several portable signal boosters tucked away behind the other equipment. Holt had positioned one in a hallway on the 27th floor. He was worried that the signal strength would not be strong enough, even with special enhancement. But any concerns he might have had were dispelled the instant Arkadya Rokossovsky splattered like a fat Russian meatball across the pavement of Fifth Avenue. A crowd had quickly formed around the ambassador's body. The gawkers offered unintentional cover. Holtz had slipped back inside the building to retrieve the booster. When he was gone, Eric von Breslau motioned Holtz's assistant to him. Even though they were alone in the back of the white van, he pitched his voice low.
I have been in contact with the village. Our Lothar Holtz has not been entirely forthright with me.
The blonde-haired man was listening, but there was a distracting twitch at the corner of his mouth. It was a nervous tick that had developed late in the morning. It had grown steadily worse as the afternoon wore on.
He lied to me. He was instructed to return to the village. He disobeyed a direct order. Cluj is furious.
The young man stared at the Nazi doctor. Despite the muscle spasm at the corner of his mouth, his face remained impassive.
We have the new Shinanju information collected from you and the other test subjects. I will bring this back to the village. Cluj does not want attention drawn to Four. Not yet. When this fool takes us back to where the British and American are being held, you will kill him.
Holtz's assistant of the past 8 years did not even raise an eyebrow at the command. He nodded obediently, ever so slightly. The corner of his mouth twitched in punctuation.
It was risky for the two of you to go out like that.
Sorry, but we didn't exactly feel like sitting around for a month twiddling our thumbs.
It appears that might not be necessary. Did you catch the news?
Yeah, we heard it on the radio on the way over. It sounds like the poor guy was programmed to off himself.
I agree. And to shatter the window as he did obviously required Shinanju skills.
Only minor ones, Emperor.
That is neither here nor there. The point is, Holtz has retrieved the Shinanju information from his victims.
Yeah, well, it won't do him any good, Smitty. All the guys we went to were either dead or dying. They can't adapt.
Yes, that is true. However, if they slow down the process to take weeks, months, or perhaps even years in order to allow the host time to absorb the information, the process might still work. Your skills could conceivably be sold to terrorist nations or organized crime syndicates, or for that matter, to any petty criminal.
Savages! They would be stealing prospective clients away from Shinanju.
Indeed. The British and American ambassadors haven't turned up?
Not yet. But we can assume Holtz has similar fates planned for each of them. It is clearly his way of paying back the Allied nations for the defeat of Nazi Germany.
You been able to find out anything about him yet?
No, but I have a suspicion.
Smith stared off distractedly at the distant wall.
Yo! Earth to Smitty! Care to share it with us?
Oh. I am sorry. The past 3 days are beginning to take their toll. My suspicions concerning Holtz are unfounded at the present time, and they are irrelevant to the current investigation.
If you say so.
I've done some further checking. Though I was unable to locate any concrete information concerning Lothar Holtz, I have found something that might be significant. You said the warehouse to which he brought the ambassadors was within an hour or so of the Edison facility. That automatically eliminates most of their New York properties.
I wish I could narrow it down better, but my system was so out of whack I couldn't even tell north from south.
Alas, the even more powerful signal employed on me dulled my senses as well, Emperor.
It might not matter. Given the time interval, there are not many places he could have reached by car. There is a warehouse in Jersey City that is owned by Platt Deutsche. It is both convenient to New York City and to Edison. I want you to begin there.
I hope this isn't just busy work.
It is a start.
Reaching into an open desk drawer, Smith retrieved 2 small flat plastic discs.
I want you each to carry one of these.
Smelling a free gift, Chun bullied his way in front of Remo. He snatched the small item from Smith's hand, examining it carefully.
A talisman?
Something like that.
This seemed to satisfy Chun. The small object disappeared inside the folds of his kimono. Remo had taken one of the preferred items as well. He flipped it over in his hand. Small wires extended from the body of the device. He could feel the faint hum of a battery.
Huh. What is it?
Possibly nothing. Consider it a good luck charm.
Come, Remo. With our Emperor's talisman in hand, we cannot fail.
Remo glanced skeptically from the small object to the cure director. Smith looked absolutely exhausted. The strain of the past few days had drained him both physically and emotionally. Remo did not press him.
Whatever.
Slipping the object into the front pocket of his chinos, he and Chun headed out the door. Lothar Holtz knew he was risking everything. By defying Adolf Kluge, he had made himself a powerful enemy. But even Kluge might change his mind, albeit grudgingly, if Holtz was able to turn the situation around. And he was convinced he could do just that. He knew that those from Shinanju would eventually find this warehouse. It had been a public real estate transaction made several years before. Platt Deutsche had no reason to keep it secret. They had intended to use it for storage, but never had. It would only be a matter of time before Smith uncovered it. He would eventually send his enforcers here. If Holtz could obtain another complete copy of their neural files, either of the young one or the old one, he could claim a resounding victory. As it stood now, he had only been able to reclaim a small fraction of their capabilities. He planned to download one of them and run before they had a chance to catch him. If he succeeded, even Kluge might come around. Of course, Kluge had been upset by the abductions, but the old ones in the village would savor the victory, and some of the old ones still had influence. No, this was the answer. He would return to the village a hero instead of a bumbling clown, and his victory would put him back on the fast track. Holtz drove the white van behind the decrepit warehouse and circled around the building, negotiating the tricky path through the pothole-filled drive. The rear lot was a shambles, tufts of crabgrass and dandelions pushed up through sections of cracked asphalt. Wet papers and crushed beer cans were strewed everywhere. At one time, a pile of sand had been dumped toward the rear of the lot, but over the years, most of it had washed down over the remaining patches of faded tar. An abandoned car, stripped of doors and tires, lay in one corner, exposed to the elements like the bleached skeleton of some long-dead desert animal. Holtz tucked the interface van beneath the shadow of the abandoned warehouse. Where he parked, the main road was clearly visible around the far rear corner of the building.
Beckett's a warehouse.
Stay alert back there, Herr Doctor. We do not know how soon they will be here.
If at all.
Von Breslau glanced at Holtz's blonde assistant from the rear of the van. The young man sat silently in the passenger seat. The bandage on his shoulder was stained a deep brown. Holtz placed the earpiece for his transceiver in his ear.
They will come. The device is in working condition?
Yes, yes. They have tested it twice already on the way here.
I simply have no intention of being trapped in the warehouse with our future guests. Please prepare our present guests for the welcome. I'll keep in touch.
The instant Holtz left the van, Von Breslau nodded slightly to the young blonde man. In spite of his severe twitching, which had gotten worse on the trip from New York, Holtz's assistant nodded back. The young man trailed his master to the decrepit building. The old Nazi doctor watched them go through hooded eyes.
I will be prepared, Lothar, but I fear you will not be.
Remo and Chun took the Holland Tunnel beneath the Hudson River to Jersey City. Chun sat beside Remo in the front seat. He had removed the object Smith had given him and was examining it carefully.
Stop looking at that thing as if it's gonna do something.
Pray to your gods that Smith's talisman is strong enough to ward off the evils of the inner phase.
I wouldn't count on any hocus pocus to save us. Smith didn't sound too sure that that whatever it is would work. All I can say is we'd better hit hard and fast.
We will prevail.
Remo followed Smith's directions to the letter. They found the building in a bombed-out section of town. An old, faded sign identified the place as the former home of Ingalls Meatpacking Distributors, Inc. The sign at one time had stretched the length of the building. The place looked familiar to Remo. He did not know if it was because this was the same warehouse he and Chun had been to the day before, or if it merely provoked the same sorry desperation of all abandoned buildings.
Well, this is it. Time to go. And put that thing away!
The Nazi doctor watched the two men glide into the building. Their shapes were ghostly on the thermal monitor. Four other spectral images registered elsewhere in the building. Von Breslau entered the final elementary commands into two of the shapes. All was ready for the final trap. He found that the dynamic interface system allowed him to operate most men simply. It was a matter of entering the proper commands beforehand. Rokossovsky had been easy to program, but he remembered Newton mentioning the difficulty he had had at first controlling the Shinenju Masters. He had needed an entire team to control one man. That wouldn't matter to Von Breslau. He didn't need to manipulate them at first, only to stop them. That, he was told by Newton, was relatively easy. He saw the spectral outlines of Lothar Holtz and his assistant. Von Breslau would soon send a message ordering the young man to attack Holtz. He would wait until Holtz was cornered. That Holtz deserved to die wasn't even in question. Any fool who lied to Adolf Kluge had earned death. But his death wouldn't be entirely in vain. Von Breslau planned to follow through on part of Lothar Holtz's plan. Once the men from Shinenju were frozen like statues, he would download the information from one of them into the computer. Copies of the files would be brought back with him to the village for study and further testing. But he had one final debt to repay. Before he left, he would enter one last command. He would use the dynamic interface system to order the young one to kill the master of Shinenju. It was the same building, Remo had no doubt. He and Chun saw the marks on the dirty floor where they had left the three bound ambassadors. Rokossovsky was dead. Sir Jeffrey Hyde Black and Helena Eckert were missing as well. Remo sensed movement to one side of the building. There was a staircase running up to a second floor. The master of Shinenju indicated the direction with a bony, upturned chin. Remo nodded. He and Chun made their way toward the stairs. As they made their stealthy way across the floor, Remo suddenly felt the telltale itchiness at the base of his skull, the controlling signal of the dynamic interface system. He glanced at Chun. The master of Shinenju was obviously experiencing the same sensation. But this time, Remo knew that it was different. The command that until now had allowed the system operators to control their actions was somehow faulty. This time, they could still move. Chun smiled tightly, patting that area of his robe where the strange object from Smith was hidden. They headed for the stairs. The rotted staircase ended at a broad landing that overlooked the main warehouse space far below. A single narrow hallway led away from the top step. It ended at a broken, grimy window far away. The hall was flanked on both sides by ancient office doors. Some were broken off their hinges, but most were surprisingly well preserved. At the entrance to the hallway, Remo hesitated. There were four occupants. He couldn't tell exactly where two of them were. He could only place them farther down the hall, but the second pair was nearby. He could also sense that their breathing was too perfect for normal humans. It was almost Shinanju. Remo turned to warn Chun of the danger.
Little father, there.
Secretary of State Helena Eckert landed hard on the floor, her flying kick expertly countered by Remo. Immediately, she sprang to her feet, holding her hands out before her in a classic Shinanju attack pose. It was one used by beginners, a throwback to the times when Shinanju masters competed in public contests. Remo could see her fleshy knuckle dimples as she brandished her hand menacingly. Behind Remo, Chun had his own problem to deal with. Sir Jeffrey Hyde Black had launched a rapid series of deadly multiple thrusts against the master of Shinanju. Chun avoided or blocked each strike with relative ease. Soon, Chun saw an opening. Sir Jeffrey crushed a desk with his weight, but suddenly sprang back to his feet.
Don't kill him, little father!
Would you suggest I let him kill me?
Just immobilize him!
Eckert was down. The British ambassador threw out another mallet-like fist. The master of Shinanju grabbed the fist and spun the man around like a top. His hand clamped down on Sir Jeffrey's neck. The man was disabled, Chun's hand to the back of his neck. Carrying Helena Eckert like an overfilled bag of groceries, Remo crossed over to Chun. He had an unhappy expression on his face.
What do we do with these now, oh wise one? For if we let them go, they will be made to attack us once more.
Wait a minute, Chun. Do you hear something funny?
At the rear of the building, Lothar Holtz heard the fight. His assistant stood nearby, closer, it seemed, than usual. The shaking had become almost unbearable. Holtz pressed his fingers against the earpiece.
They're here! You were supposed to tell me if they were coming! Von Breslau! Scheiße!
Holtz glanced around desperately. He had to get out. He couldn't be caught here. Luckily, the rear rooms all opened onto the fire escape. He'd get down to the van. He could not allow these men to capture him. Quickly, he turned toward the rear door. He was just fast enough to see his assistant flash from out of his peripheral vision. The man's fist moved lightning fast in a direct line for his face. He was astonished by what happened next. Lothar Holtz looked on, bewildered, almost a spectator to the actions of his own body. 1 minute before, Von Breslau had been fussing impatiently with the equipment in the van. He couldn't get a lock on the Shinanju men. He had tried, but the dynamic interface system stubbornly refused to work. He didn't understand the intricacies of the system. If it didn't work, it didn't work. He had gotten some information from the young one. That would have to suffice. He only wished he had been responsible for the death of the master of Shinanju. But that could still happen, even in his lifetime. He had the information that could be used to ultimately destroy the old Korean. In a year, perhaps two. But first things first, he used the interface system to enter a command into the mind of one of the men in the building. It was to Holtz's assistant. He told the man to kill Lothar Holtz. Von Breslau waited what he felt was an appropriate amount of time and then cut the signals to both ambassadors. If the blonde mute was still in the room when the Shinanju men got there, it was his own fault. And anyway, he was expendable. Von Breslau was not. This task accomplished, the good doctor climbed up into the cab of the mobile interface van and started the engine.
Hold up, little father. Eckert's gone limp.
Mine has become like boiled noodles.
I think they're safe to let go.
Yes.
Chun!
Oops.
Running to the window at the end of the hall, Remo was just in time to see the rear of the dynamic interface system's van clear the side of the building. Its twisted rear door bounced roughly along with the rest of the frame through the potholed driveway, sending up plumes of sandy smoke. A second later, it reached the road. Engine flat out, the truck thundered off. It was gone. Remo stood near the door from which he had sensed movement a few moments before. There was nothing now. He hoped Holtz hadn't gotten away again. Remo pushed open the door. In the middle of the untidy room, a body lay twisted on the floor. The face was an unrecognizable pulp. It resembled a pile of raw hamburger. The blood-streaked hair was wrenched out by the roots. All that remained were patchy, mottled clumps. The entire head, hands, and torso were soaked with blood. Remo looked more closely. He saw it, the tiny radio earpiece Holtz was so fond of wearing. He heard Chun enter the room behind him.
His assistant must have killed him. These are Shinanju moves. Ugh, carried to the extreme, though. What a mess.
It was probably understandable. By now, Holtz's assistant would have been experiencing the final side effects of the Shinanju download. He had been in better physical shape than the other test subjects, but he wouldn't be able to hold on to it much longer than the rest. He had already begun experiencing the same savage physical outburst some of the others had had at the end. His wild, mindless attack was proof. He could no longer stop himself. The killing blows had been repeated over and over, even after Holtz must surely have died. It was totally unfocused. Remo went over to the window. He saw the rusty old fire escape. He must have escaped out the window. It didn't matter. Wherever he was, the young man would be dead by morning. Remo turned to leave. Chun was standing by the bloody body, looking on with a curiously musing expression.
We'd better get the ambassadors out of here. Maybe Smitty can do something to get that programming out of them.
He headed out into the hallway. Chun didn't move.
You coming?
Turning away from the body, Chun slowly trailed Remo out into the hall. His mouth was a somber frown. Von Breslau registered at the hotel under the name Heinrich Kolb. No one asked him why he had no luggage. All he carried with him was a large box tucked under one arm and a brown grocery bag that swung from his gnarled hand by its handles. When the bellboy offered to carry the items for him, the elderly man cheerily declined. Alone in his room, he placed the box on the neatly made bed. He set the bag on the floor. Cluj had made arrangements for him to leave the country tomorrow. He had a 9 a.m. flight out of JFK. Von Breslau had spent the better part of the afternoon and early evening copying files from the van computers onto portable hard drives. What he ended up with filled a container twice as large as a standard shoebox. This was the box he placed on the bed. From the bag, he took several items: scissors, brown paper, a marking pen, and a roll of packing tape. He arranged the hard drives snugly in the box, shoving a hotel hand towel in around the cargo to fill up the vacant space. Taking great care, he wrapped and taped the box for shipment. He did not address it. That could wait until morning. When he called down for a cab, he would have someone at the front desk mail the package for him. Von Breslau left the box on the nightstand and undressed for bed. He didn't know what time he awoke. At first, he thought he was dreaming. It was a sensation of floating, of gentle hands bearing him softly through the air. He tried to get his bearings. He felt himself getting lifted, higher. It was cold out here. Von Breslau shivered in his underwear. He saw the chimneys, like something out of his past, 50 years before. Then they had belched a thick, acrid smoke, the smell of burning flesh weighing heavy in the frigid winter air. The chimneys he saw now were idle. He floated in close to one, very close. He saw the rough surface of the grimy bricks. Then he was up. Sure hands guided him to the very top. He saw the New York skyline, dazzlingly white, a sea of lights spreading out brilliantly around him. Then he saw the gaping maw of the chimney, up close. The blackness slid around his head. He felt the tightness at his bony shoulders. The blood rushed to his head. His arms were pinned to his sides. He was unable to move.
What is it you want? I can't get your money. Gold. Anything.
Gold is generally an acceptable form of payment.
The master of Shinanju?
And the young one, yeah. Gold is pretty good, by the way.
I could promise you a fortune. It is guaranteed!
Von Breslau tried to move his head. Fragments of black grit jarred loose from the chimney's wall and fell into his eyes. He blinked but could not dislodge the painful flakes.
What do you think, little father?
It is a tempting offer, admittedly. But I do not feel it is time yet to do business with the Hun. My memory of the little jester with the funny mustache is too recent. Perhaps in another 100 years or so, my attitude could change.
I think that's fair. Don't go anywhere. We'll get back to you.
Von Breslau felt the young one slip something around his big toe.
Hello? Hello? Anybody?
6 months later, when a maintenance crew discovered the body stuffed down into the mouth of the chimney, the story would make national news. Public interest in the case would generate an extensive investigation, and it would ultimately be discovered that the deceased was none other than the infamous Dr. Erich von Breslau. With the resulting media firestorm, the hotel would begin to wish they had paid attention to the note left by the killer. Whoever had put the body there had kindly placed a do not disturb sign on the old man's toe.
You might have done it more neatly.
I don't want to hear it, Smitty. It felt right.
The look on Remo's face suggested that Smith not press the issue.
This box full of hard drives is all he had with him.
That was it. Oh, here. I'm not sure, but I think this little gizmo worked.
I thought it might.
Smith put down the box and picked up the object. He flipped it over in the palm of his hand.
So what is it?
It is a pacemaker. You recall I had one implanted recently. That was why I was in New York earlier this week, to see my doctor. The signal must have somehow interfered with the immobilizing aspect of the dynamic interface system's signal. If it worked for me, I hoped that it would work for both of you as well.
Your talisman was most effective, Emperor. It appears, though Shinanju be your greatest sword, that there are other weapons in your mighty arsenal.
A pacemaker?
Smith replaced the flat object on his desk and picked up von Breslau's box. He frowned as he turned it over in his hands.
You know, Remo, this looked as though it was packed for shipping. I wonder where von Breslau was sending it.
He and Holtz talked about something called IV.
Yes, you mentioned that to me earlier. I did some checking, and I could find no reference to a IV organization in any of the pro- or neo-Nazi literature. It is probably merely a minor splinter group. I would not be concerned.
Well, if this is all wrapped up, Chun and I will get going.
Do not be too hasty. There is still a minor item.
What? Oh, Chun, can't you collect your autograph later?
Autograph? Oh, yes. Of course. You realize, Master of Shinanju, that due to the need for secrecy in the organization, you may not show this to anyone.
To no one at all?
I am afraid not.
Therefore, selling it is out of the question?
I must insist. Well, here you go.
I have just remembered that I have many of your autographs already. They grace the contracts you have signed with the House of Shinanju. Long live Emperor Smith.
Of course. Well, if this matter is finished, we should all go home and get some rest. It has been a very long week.
Actually, there is another trifling item.
Harold W. Smith trudged wearily up the stairs to his bedroom. He had taken his shoes off at the door and carried them so as not to wake his wife so late. Only when he entered the room did he remember that Maud had gone out of town to visit their daughter. She had been telling him for weeks. Like so much of his life that did not revolve around his work, Smith had just simply forgotten. He removed his jacket and tie and lay down atop the bed covers. He was so drained he didn't have the energy to put on his pajamas. He lay there for a few long seconds, in dress shirt and pants, staring at the shadows of the room. It had been a grueling, grueling week. He had denied his body sleep for so long he began to see things in the room around him. Strange black shapes flitted out from the corners as car headlights dragged through the room and across the walls. A patch of darkness seemed to coalesce. It was a bizarre vision. He saw the face of Captain Joseph Mink fade up out of the shadows. It was an eerie image in a week of foolish daydreams. His exhausted mind was playing tricks on him.
You destroyed everything.
Smith was immediately alert. The voice was real. It was in his room. He sat up in bed.
You did it to yourself.
No, It was you! You started this downward spiral! You ruined my life!
Holtz's eyes glared hatefully at Smith, and Smith fully saw the family resemblance.
I refuse to be blamed for your personal failings.
Holtz took another step.
At the lab, you spoke of Usedom.
Yes?
You are the one. You killed Joseph Menk.
I did what I had to do.
You killed my grandfather!
Your grandfather was a murderer.
No! No! My grandfather was a great man!
With no warning, Holtz lunged for Smith. At the last minute, a long nailed hand swiped down from out of the shadows. The master of Shinanju stepped out of the shadows, talons raised protectively. He positioned himself between Smith and Holtz. Remo seemed to fade in as well. He moved away from Chun toward Lothar Holtz. Holtz stood shuddering. The spastic contortions his muscles were making made it difficult for him to focus. He saw Remo moving toward him. He braced himself for an attack.
I would stay back if I were you. I learned how to use the system. My assistant couldn't move against me quick enough. I had to kill him. And now your reign is about to come to an end. Because I have all your programming. It's all up here.
Then it's time I crashed your system.
Holtz flew at Remo, hands flashing frenetically. He threw everything he had into one assault. Every Shinanju move the computer link had loaded into his mind. Holtz went for the complex, but Remo opted for the elementary. When the Platt Deutsche Vice President was within arm's reach, Remo went for Holtz's temple. Holtz felt the pressure in his skull. The new eyes Shinanju had given him were still quick enough to see the hand pull away. The pain in his brain joined the crescendo of agony that had been building in his spine, and in a white-hot moment of pure torture, every pain receptor along his entire nervous system fired in perfect harmonic torment. The intense, horrific, excruciating anguish he suffered seemed to last an eternity. In reality, it was only a matter of seconds. Lothar Holtz was dead before he hit the floor.
Your suspicion was correct, Master of Shinanju.
Chun bowed slightly.
How did you know it wasn't him back at the warehouse?
Because I use my eyes for seeing. I do not yet know what it is you do with yours. Come, Remo. Remove this refuse from the Emperor's bedchambers. We go.
With that, Chun marched boldly out the door and down the stairs. Remo stared after him for a few seconds. Finally, he turned to Smith.
You'd think I would have wanted them to rewrite his program just a little.
And with that, he hefted the body of Lothar Holtz up onto his shoulders and followed the Master of Shinanju out the door.
The Destroyer, Brainstorm, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1998, Warren Murphy. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. With performances by Ken Jackson, Christopher Grayville, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, James Lewis, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Ariane Harper, Dylan Lynch, Michael Replogle, Thomas Penny, and Mort Shelby. Additional Richards performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton and Nathaniel Perry. The Destroyer theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Brian Patton, Nathaniel Perry, Dan Smith, and Matt Webb. Book adapted for graphic audio by Dan Smith. If you enjoyed The Destroyer, be sure to look for our other exciting titles, available at Roadstops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. And go to the Glorious House of Shinanju at www.warrenmurphy.com.
creators that brought you the critically acclaimed Eagles series comes a whole new kind of Western. Far from the civilized lands of the East lies a harsh and brutal territory, surrounded by towering mountains and battered by howling winds. There is no law. There are no rules. The land is governed by the way of the gun. Blood is the only currency, and all debts are paid in full. In this land, there is a legend.
Some people say he's always been here. They say he's as old as the mountains. They say he's a ghost.
Running from a past he can't escape, killing in order to live, his legend grows. No one knows his face. They all know his name.
Who are you?
They call me Preacher.
The High Lonesome is his land. He rides alone, fighting for the innocent. The wicked be damned. He is the ghost of the wilds. He is the first mountain man. He is Preacher.
What are you gonna do now?
I'm gonna find him, and I'm gonna kill every damn one of them.
The danger is real.
Can't breathe.
The threat is vast.
New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas, Washington. We surrender or else millions of Americans die. That's what we face.
The conspiracy spreads.
We have every kind of creep and they're all in on this Hydra operation. With the information they've given us, we have identified bases in Nicaragua and Florida.
And the only thing that can stop it are the combined forces of Able Team, Phoenix Force, and Matt Bolin. Stony Man. Go back to where the legend of Stony Man begins.
See? You got your backup, Carl.
Don't use my name, all right? Standard nicknames, fellas. Politician, gadgets.
And what's your name?
Iron Man. It's time to go to work.
December 2007.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.